Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. The United States bans almost all commercial trade of African elephant ivory. States are also passing their own laws that mirror the national one with an addition. Some states are also adding walrus, among other animals, to the no list. Some of these added animal ivory bans are compromising the livelihood of some Alaska Native artists. In the next hour, we'll discuss this issue. We hope you'll join the conversation, too. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A standoff between people opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline and law enforcement took place at a creek in North Dakota Wednesday. Native people opposing the pipeline say they were there to pray and were trying to cross the creek to access a sacred site. Videos circulated social media Wednesday afternoon showing people being pepper sprayed as they stood in the creek as officers held a line on one side of the bank. According to the Martin County Sheriff's Department, officers removed a man-made bridge and were directed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to remove anyone who entered Corps land. Wednesday's standoff comes nearly a week after more than 140 arrests were made by militarized police along a highway. One of those arrested was the chairman of the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe. As he tells Jim Kent, he was shocked by how they were treated by law enforcement.
Brendan Sazu was delivering firewood to the camp near Cannonball, North Dakota, when a call came to support those gathered near the Dakota Access Pipeline construction site.
They were getting pepper sprayed. There was shots fired into the crowd with the canisters, with the gas, and it was total chaos. I couldn't walk away from that.
Sazu was arrested. While he sat waiting to be transported from the site, Sazu saw what he described as desecration of teepee poles.
Bobcat was in a ditch, running over them like they were nothing, and picking them up, throwing them over the fences. They're shooting at the horses. They were shooting at the horse riders. And those are only 18, 19-year-old boys. My heart was just falling.
The worst part, says Sazu, was when they arrived at the Morton County Jail.
So we pull in the garage, and they got big dog kennels in there, already pre-made for everybody. I mean, elderly to the young ones. I never seen anything like it. You know, it's right out of a movie scene about what they did to the Jews. I understood that because my number they wrote on my arm was 137. They assigned me a number.
Personnel at the Morton County Jail would not comment on assigning serial numbers to prisoners, but in an email response noted that there are 6 temporary chain-link holding cells used for mass arrest situations. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Northern Minnesota is home to 7 Anishinaabe reservations where the Native voter turnout is typically low. Ramona Morozes has more.
Indigenous people, they just don't care because they don't feel like their voice counts.
Renee Van Nett feels many Natives have little incentive to go to the polls. She lives in Duluth and is from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. She tried and failed to win a Duluth school board seat last year. As the Anishinaabe tradition of everything coming full circle, she wants the Anishinaabe to return to their roots of being participants in the political sphere.
I try to talk to them about that, but they just don't care. I think it's an underrepresented voice.
Building that tradition, Van Nett says, is all the more difficult when candidates don't address issues that are important to Native communities, like substance abuse, historical trauma, the environment, and the Indian Child Welfare Act, to name a few. In Minnesota, motivation is a big barrier for Native voters, says Mark Trahant, a journalism professor at the University of North Dakota, who came to Duluth's American Indian Center to speak about Natives in politics.
2 states, Montana and New Mexico, Native Americans actually voted a higher percentage than the population. And that's something I'd love to see spread to other states.
Other obstacles for Native voters include geography. Polls could be as far as 100 miles away. Van Nett, who's also a liaison with Community Action Duluth, puts the time and mileage in to get Native voters to polling places.
If someone needs a ride, we'll go get them. Bring them there, show them what's going on, just get them there.
Van Nett says Native voters often benefit from basic education about who's on the ballot and where they go to vote. For National Native News, I'm Ramona Morozes with Kate Harrison in Duluth.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
As an American Indian or Alaska Native, you help elders, young people, and Native businesses when you exercise your right to vote. Your vote makes a difference in Washington and at home. More information at nativenews.net, brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Support by VisionMaker Media, whose mission is to empower and engage Native people to tell stories. VisionMaker Media celebrates 40 years by streaming 40 films in 40 weeks. More information, including titles and dates, can be found at visionmakermedia.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Alaska Natives have a long history of sculpting walrus ivory. And today, there are many Alaska Native artists that rely on ivory carvings to make their livelihood. But new bans on ivory have artists worried that some markets might be closed off. Over the summer, the U.S. enacted a near-total ban on the commercial trade of African elephant ivory. The law is designed to protect endangered elephants. States have also flexed their legal arm too. A California law goes further with listing other animals' ivory as banned. California lists walrus tusks as among forbidden items, even though walruses are not endangered. It's also important to today's discussion to make note that Alaska Natives are legally allowed to carve and use these tusks. And this has created a stir in the Alaska Native artist community. Today, we'll talk with an artist about this and how they use these tusks. We'll also get an environmental perspective on walruses, too. And what do you think about ivory bands? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-99-NATIVE. That's also 1-800-996-2848. And now joining us from the Puyallup, Washington, is Susie Silluk, and she's a traditional and contemporary artist and writer. And Susie is St. Lawrence Island Yupik. It's our pleasure to have Susie here with us today. Susie, thank you for joining us.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having us on your show to discuss this important issue. I just want to say really quick, shout out to everyone at Standing Rock. You know, even though I'm not there in person, there's a lot of us in solidarity with you in spirit. So just hang tough, stay strong.
And, you know, Susie, mentioning that a lot of the things that we hear coming from that area is actually protecting a Native way of life, protecting culture, protecting the land. And I think that ties directly into what we're about to jump into here. Susie, let's go ahead and make those connections. Tell us a little bit about how culture connects to walrus tusk.
I know I spoke with someone beforehand about this whole walrus ivory ban issue on Native America Calling, and I was a little shocked at the how little information is out there about our culture and the importance of the walrus within this whole framework of culture. It's, you know, the walrus is our primary food source right there on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. And our people also extend over onto the Russian side, our clans. So on both sides, that we depend on the walrus. And, you know, it's historically been used for the flooring, for our housing. You can split the female walrus hide in two, and that's what we make the skin boats from. It's made into strong rope. Traditionally, you would make these things called meatballs with the food inside the hide, and those would be used for trade. So it's always been a source of trade. We would trade across the waters for, you know, like reindeer items and things like that that aren't readily available on the island. And ivory has always been used for either tools or for toys or artwork, religious items. It's got a range of uses. It's a beautiful material. It's pretty durable. You can use it for the runners under your sleds, you know, the sled runners. Those were made from ivory. So it's just been this, it's inseparable from the culture. I really don't know how to describe it any further than that.
And Susie, would you say that it has been everywhere and a part of your life all the years that you can count?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I grew up, there were eight of us, and sometimes I remember not having any food in the house until my father came home from hunting. And then, my mom would prepare the food, and we'd all sit around the platter. I've got a poem about sitting around Ma's platter, and eating with our fingers. So it was very real, this immediate sense of where your food comes from and who provides it for you. And I grew up on Lars. My father, so was my grandfather. I think my grandfather he did some artwork with ivory, but my father used a lot of ivory in his work. But it's important to say here that, like you said, the states are also expanding their list of banned items, and on that list is also polar bear, whale products, sea otter. And again, those are all arts resources from our food sources and that we're allowed to use in our artwork under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. I would say that whalebone is almost as important an arts medium as the walrus ivory is. There's a lot of people that use that. And a lot of the whalebone that we use is ancestral whalebone. It's not, it takes quite a bit of time for it to cure enough to be used for artwork. And that's mainly done out in nature. So a lot of the whalebone that we use was harvested, centuries back. And that's an important resource also. You're just seeing this growing list of items of things we use to express ourselves culturally and also to help us economically. And especially on the village level where I grew up, it is the only resource. I was talking to the manager at the Village Native Corporation back home, Erica Paddocky, and I asked her about the current unemployment rates there. And she quoted 75%. So, that number is kind of misleading. That means Western-style jobs, the 8 to 5 or 9 to 5. Whereas, that doesn't mean that people are sitting around idle, that people have always been and still are engaged in subsistence, food gathering, hunting activity that takes up a lot of time and resource. So, but it is like the only economic resource there.
So putting any kind of ban or a pinch in the flow of not only creativity, but also some of what you've shared, I can see how it has jolted the lives of some folks. And folks, maybe you're one of them. If you'd like to share your story, you can give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Susie, when you heard about some of the bans across the nation, and there's some on the books, there's some that are in a holding pattern, what does this really shake up? What do you think, and is there any kind of message that you think comes along with bans like this?
Well, it was pretty unbelievable. So much of our culture has been taken from us. Thankfully, on St. Lawrence Island, because of our isolation, we've retained quite a bit of our language, although that is beginning to show some signs of deterioration amongst the younger people. But, we've experienced all the same cultural changes as, the rest of Native America. And, the things that we hold tight to are really largely sometimes the arts, and the songs, the dances, all of that helps us to keep our sense of identity strong in the face of tremendous pressure to assimilate and to change and to live life according to the dominant culture's rules. And for me, that connection with the ivory and the way that I've been taught by my father and my grandfather was a writer also, it's helped me all these years, no matter where I've lived, to keep my culture inside myself and those values, which are so beautiful, that I would really hate to see us lose. It's pretty astounding. This isn't just a ban on ivory. It's almost like a ban on your culture, a further ban. And really, I think we've lost enough. We have to seriously draw the line here, you know?
I wonder how many people out there feel the same way. Folks, you can call in, give us a ring, 1-800-996-2848 is the number if there's anything you'd like to share. Also, do you use walrus ivory in your daily life? What about in your art? Give us a call and share how these bands are affecting you, your life, your business, and culture. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And maybe you're on another side of this and you support the bands. Anybody is welcome to this conversation. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Susie, we're going to say hello to another voice here with us on the line from Nome, Alaska. We have Vera Metcalf. She is a director of the Eskimo Walrus Commission, and Vera is St. Lawrence Island Yupik. It's our pleasure to have her here with us today. And Vera, welcome to the hour.
Yes, thank you, Tara. Yes, I live here in Nome, but I'm actually born and raised in Savunga, which is the neighboring community where Susie is from, Gambo. Savunga and Savunga are the two communities out on St. Lawrence Island. But I do work for the Eskimo Walrus Commission. We are basically an advocacy group representing about 19 coastal marine mammal hunting communities from Barrow down to Bristol Bay. We try to address issues that concerns us involving our natural and cultural resources for many of our communities. Susie mentioned the political pressures we have, we often face, including this ivory ban. As a Walrus Commission, we try to address many of these policy issues and research activities that concerns Alaska Natives, especially if they're going to have potential negative implications. So we make our decisions based on working with the communities we represent, the 19 coastal communities, as directly as possible, including our community leaders and commissioners, as one of the Alaska Native organizations in this state. So we try not to make presumed decisions for our communities we represent, but only act on their behalf with their explicit consent. And we are concerned about this ivory ban. We met in June 2016, our executive committee met and came up with a resolution that was moved forward, and we have received many other supporting resolutions from the communities throughout this region and Barrow and Bristol Bay. So it is a big concern to us here at the commission.
And that's why we're doing this show, to just hear where people stand on this, how it's affecting your life. And folks, we got plenty of time in the hour. If you'd like to share a perspective from your own community, from your village, give us a ring, 1-800-996-2848. And also, how does this affect other Native nations? If you are seeing parallels to maybe bans that have been put on things that are essential to your community, what do you think about hearing another nation facing similar issues? Give us a ring, 1-800-996-2848. Ladies, I want to share a voice that came out of some work with the producers with the Alaska Native Voice radio program. They interviewed the U.S. Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, last month in Fairbanks, Alaska, at this year's Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. And they interviewed her on the challenges of Alaska Native artists, and especially the ones who work with walrus ivory and are encountering issues in connection to the federal law on elephant ivory. Jewel says there needs to be better communication when it comes to this law and Alaska Native arts.
So yes, the Fish and Wildlife Service can work with Native communities to authenticate walrus ivory and to help educate border agents and so on the kind of paperwork that's important to legitimize these objects. So I'm not exactly sure what is in process, but that is something that I'm going to follow up on with my team to make sure we can make it easy for tribal artisans to comply. But what we don't want to do is to create a loophole. And those who are poaching elephants around the world are very creative at exploiting every single loophole that's out there to transport illegally obtained ivory. It's pretty easy for someone that knows what they're looking at to tell the difference between walrus ivory and elephant ivory, but it's not easy for an untrained eye. And that is something that we can facilitate by a stamp of approval, as you suggest, or an authentication. And so I'm going to follow up on that when I go back.
Okay. And Susie, how does it make you feel hearing U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell saying these things, especially hearing we have to keep Native artists in mind?
Well, I wish they'd done that at the beginning. We should have been consulted in this issue, I believe, because we are a source country for ivory. But what she says about creating a loophole for other ivories to come in, elephant ivory and mammoth ivory has those cross-hatching, those lines that, you know, it's very easy to see them. The lines that go up and down and cross-hatch each other. Walrus ivory doesn't have that. It only has that on the teeth, and the teeth are small. So just when you look at the whole tusk, it's also not as large as elephant ivory. All the pictures I've seen of elephant ivory tusks, those are huge tusks. And you generally don't see tusks that size in the walrus population. And the surface is different. You know, walrus ivory has those deep black lines in it on the outer layer, and then when you cut it open and you look inside, the core of the walrus ivory is also different from other ivories. It's got a marbled appearance and texture to it. So I think it's possible entirely just to look at it with your eyes and see the difference between an elephant tusk and a walrus tusk.
So definitely education needs to take place to kind of see what, you know, what the reality is. And it's interesting that something like this comes in the middle of the summer and the Alaska Federation of Natives. I'm wondering if there are folks who had a conversation about this at this year's AFN. What were some of the issues that were brought up? Did it shock you to hear that something like this, a ban could take place and trigger states to have their own ban? Folks, we want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Let's go ahead and take a call. We're going to say hello to Marlene in Deering, Alaska, tuned in on KOTZ. Marlene, thank you for your call. And what would you like to share?
Good morning. Grew up with occasionally eating elders, walrus flippers, and with them walrus, you know, food and carvers. But I have a little concern about the past several years. Maybe this was around 2005. There was a gathering in Kotzebue on artist, and on the table there is a ivory carving tusk made out of colored ink, and the traditional carvers were concerned about that because they were getting feedback on the color coming off of the ivory carving, the painting and stuff. Anyway, they suggested they use the traditional black ink, whatever they use for their carving, because it didn't make the... they sell them for over $1,000 or more for these carvings, and that's not right to sell something when the ink come off. And the other concern I have is last year or the other year, when there was a bunch of walruses, they said that were killed along the coast up north, Point Lay area or wherever, or below Point Hope. Anyway, back then we had 13 headless walrus brought into the village and no meat. And then I don't know what the outcome of the whole walrus was, but on another note, there's this people come in with a freshly headless walrus and just use it for an anchor at a point.
And Marlene, that brings up, you know, a concern, and I'm sure this has been voiced with people who talk about taking the life of any kind of animal, how it's taken and the purpose for it. And, you know, it's what we're hearing and why there's a ban on elephant ivory as well, of improper harvesting of some of these animals just to make a profit. Susie, I'm going to turn to you. Any thoughts on our caller Marlene and maybe even improper ways of taking these animals, raising concerns too? Are you hearing any of that? And any thoughts when you do hear about stuff like that?
Well, I think Vera would be the better person to answer that. She's been involved with the Walrus Commission for a long time and probably has a lot more information on the not just the level of poaching, but what drives it and what are the feelings of the community over that. I know, you know, I'm totally against that. You should respect the animal enough to take everything it has to offer you to continue with life. And also within the bigger picture here, understand there are game farms in Africa also where the animals are raised to be hunted on those lands. I mean, this issue is a lot larger than just the walrus tusks here, and it just needs more study, more deliberation. So,
sure. And you know what, Susie, I'm going to go back to one of your earlier statements of being surprised at how much awareness on this issue is lacking. And that leads us to our discussion today. Folks, is this the first time you're ever hearing about any of this? And as you get to hear more details on how it connects directly to our Native nations, what are your thoughts? Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Vera, I'm going to get your take too on poaching and any thoughts on that and how it affects the whole system of, you know, even getting to the point of connecting to the artists. Folks, we're going to take a break here, but our phone lines will remain open. You can give us a ring and share your thoughts. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And what do you think about this? Artists, I know you're out there. Give us a ring. Share what you're thinking about all of this and your point of view coming from an artist standpoint of a ban on something that affects your creativity. Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We look forward to hearing your voice on these airwaves. I'm Tara Gatewood, host of Native America Calling. On our next program, we'll discuss the new book, All the Real Indians Died Off. This book sets out to bust some of the most common myths about Native nations. We hope you'll join us for our November Book of the Month as we hear more about this project from the authors.
Medicare is your prescription for a healthy life. For anyone with Medicare, Part D provides access to affordable prescription drugs. Sign up or switch your Part D plan during open enrollment from October 15 to December 7. For more information, visit www.medicare.gov. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Support by the very first Indigenous Comic-Con in Albuquerque, New Mexico, November 18th through the 20th, featuring Indigenous creators, illustrators, writers, designers, actors, and producers from the worlds of comic books, games, sci-fi, fantasy, film, TV, and graphic novels. Indigenous Comic-Con seeks to highlight the amazing work and bring understanding about the Indigenous experience to the world of popular culture. Info on Facebook or at IndigenousComicCon.com. Everyone is welcome.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and thanks for listening to our show today. Each week, we bring you five programs that help bring light to issues that our Native nations are facing. And you can listen to our show online or on one of the many great stations that carry our show, like KYUK in Bethel, Alaska. We're talking about the ban on ivory today. Alaska Natives carve walrus ivory for artistic and also utilitarian purposes. And as we heard earlier from our guests, it is a big part of the culture. But recent efforts to protect African elephants are spilling over to these lives of Alaska Natives. In California, sale and trade of all ivory from elephants, hippopotamus, mammoth, walrus, whale, and narwhal are all prohibited. It's causing problems for some artists who have previously sold their work there. And maybe you're that person. Call in, share how this change has affected your life and your livelihood. And folks, if you're not an artist, what do you think about this ban and others like it? Call us and tell us what you think. 1-800-996-2848 or 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with us today on the line from Puyallup, Washington, is Susie Silluk. She's a traditional and contemporary artist and writer, and she comes to us from the St. Lawrence Island Yupik community. Also with us on the line from Nome, Alaska today is Vera Metcalf, and she is the director of the Eskimo Walrus Commission, and Vera is also St. Lawrence Island Yupik. It's our pleasure to have both of them here with us. And Vera, I wanted to give you a moment to just share your thoughts. We had a caller who was talking a bit about poaching or even treating animals properly when it comes to harvesting them and eventually maybe even harvesting the ivory. Vera, what's your thought on this?
Right. Thank you for that question. Marlene in Kotzebue raised a really good point. Our Walrus Commission work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, our co-management partner in these kinds of work, to encourage all of our subsistence hunting communities to harvest walrus needed for food and creation of handicrafts in compliance with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and we worked with the law enforcement and came up with some walrus harvest guidelines to encourage our communities to hunt in a non-wasteful manner. And these guidelines are always distributed to our communities. They've been translated into Yupik and Central Yupik and Inupiaq, but it kind of gives you an idea of what how much meat you need to bring back, and flippers that Marlene mentioned, and the amount of meat and hunters should bring back from a harvested walrus. So, and you know, in this guideline, they have substitutions for parts, and we encourage our, like I say, encourage our communities to hunt in a non-wasteful manner.
All right. Thank you for that. And if anybody else has more to say on this, give us a ring, 1-800-996-2848. Let's go ahead and bring more callers into this. We're going to hear from Lynn in Gallup, New Mexico, listening on KGLP. Lynn, thank you for your call, and you're on air.
Thank you. Good morning. I want to thank you for covering this topic first, because it's exactly the kind of thing that we don't hear about in mainstream media a lot, and yet it affects people directly. I want to note that there was a comment about banning Alaskan ivory because, in effect, some people can't tell the difference between that and elephant ivory and so on, and so people, you know, worried about loopholes. And this isn't a perfect comparison. It brings to mind, to me, though, the ban on growing industrial hemp. I think the Oglala Sioux tribe some years ago tried to get approval to grow industrial hemp for economic activity. And because people can't tell the difference between that and marijuana, you know, it's been blocked. So some people's ignorance is preventing some other people from carrying out legitimate activities. So that's my comment about that.
All right, Lynn, thank you for your call there in Gallup, New Mexico. Join us, too, by calling 1-800-996-2848. Let's take another call. We're going to hear from Clifton in Winchester, Idaho, tuned in on KIYE. Clifton, thank you for your call. And go ahead, jump in there.
Yes, good morning. I live in north central Idaho, and I live on the Nez Perce Indian Reservation. I have a lot of friends. I'm not Native American, that I should have been, and I think the government shouldn't have any business in dictating what they do and what they need for their artwork or what they need to sell their artwork, because they've been doing it for thousands of years. It's just really none of our business, and I sell at a lot of the powwows around, and their culture is beautiful, and I don't think the government should have any say. If they can prove they're Native American, they should be able to harvest or collect or whatever they do for anything they need for their artwork.
All right. Thank you for your call there in Idaho. Let's go ahead and take another call. We're going to hear from John in Nespelem, Washington, connecting today online. John, thank you for your call. And go ahead, share your thoughts.
Hello. It's my belief that this is promoted mainly by so-called environmentalists who do a lot more damage than they do good. And it's a form of cultural genocide, really, when they target, you know, their interests and they don't consult Native people. They've done a great deal of harm, like in you know, not cutting underbrush and so forth, which results in fires down in California. So I think they ought to leave Native people alone or consult Native people and get the federal government out of Native culture, period.
All right, John, thank you for your call. Again, phone lines are open. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And artists, where you at? We want to hear from you. What do you think about ivory bands? Give us a call. Again, the number 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And we're going to go now to Massachusetts to say hello to Margaret Williams. She is the managing director for the Arctic Program for the World Wildlife Fund. It's our pleasure to have Margaret here with us. Margaret, welcome to the hour.
Hi, Tara, and hello, Susie and Vera. Nice to be on the show with you. I am normally in Anchorage. I just happen to be in Massachusetts today, but yes, glad to speak with you on behalf of World Wildlife Fund's Arctic Program.
And Margaret, a lot has been put on the table, especially taking a look at the role environmentalists play in this. Is there anything you'd like to start off with?
Sure, absolutely. And I did want to just clarify one thing, that the ban that we're talking about, actually, I think that there's a lot of confusion, and Susie and Vera have pointed that out, and education is very much needed. The ban that has been passed is the federal ban, which only applies to elephant ivory. And that is a really important step forward because elephants are thousands and tens of thousands of elephants are being slaughtered on an annual basis because of an intense demand for use of elephant ivory. And so World Wildlife Fund supported that elephant ivory ban. But what's happening is the more extensive or expansive bans are happening on a state level. And so that's really unfortunate because, as Vera and Susie have pointed out, that is having a negative impact on people who are respectful of wildlife and harvesting this, you know, the meat and the ivory, and World Wildlife Fund has, we actually have a position that respects and acknowledges the importance of subsistence resources, and I myself have enjoyed walrus blubber and have a lot of friends who, you know, come from families who that's, you know, for whom walrus is a mainstay. So I think this show is so valuable to be able to tell listeners about the central role of walrus in Alaskan society, Native Alaskan society. But I think it's, you know, just any group can be generalized, and I think it's, you know, unfair to generalize, say, all environmentalists are problematic, or all this, you know, all companies are problematic, or all this and that is problematic, because I think my organization has worked very constructively to find solutions that work for people and wildlife. And on this matter, actually, Susie and I testified together at a hearing during the Alaska Federation of Natives. There were two other colleagues from Alaska Native corporations, and we actually shared a very similar viewpoint. We all acknowledge the importance of educating audiences and states on why, on the distinction between elephant ivory and walrus ivory. And I could elaborate there. I'm talking a lot, but anyway, lots to say on the subject.
Indeed. And Margaret, thanks for resetting and reminding folks that where some of this controversy comes is what some of the states are initiating. And Margaret, do you have any understanding or information or take on why states are including walrus as they mirror what the national ban has been put out? How did we get to this point?
Well, unfortunately, we did not work as extensively on the state level as other organizations, but I think in part it's misunderstanding. About the issue that Susie and others have pointed out, the concern about lookalikes, and any expert can, and really I think not even an expert, you need to be an expert to distinguish elephant ivory from walrus ivory. So I think that's just, to me, it seems like a misguided, uneducated approach to have sweeping measures like that.
And, you know, there's probably people out there who are also wondering, well, maybe it's all because of the populations of walrus. We're going to go ahead and bring you a voice now. We spoke with Rose Fostick about this topic, and she is the vice president of the Natural Resources Division at the Kuwerik Incorporated. And she is Inupiaq, and we asked her about the health of the Pacific walrus population.
Walrus are doing just fine as a population, and walrus have never been endangered as to the population because of harvest by Alaska Native people. It is a food source. It's something we value as a food. Items from walrus are used for homes. You know, walrus skins are used in skin boats. Ivory is used in many different things, not just for sale, but for example, my dad made handles out of ivory for carving. So it's a very valuable item to us, not only for arts and crafts, but for our use too. I think if the states need to understand what they're doing and understand that there's a difference between walrus ivory and elephant ivory, and include that if they do pass laws for their state, that they should be very clear about what the law is, that it relates to elephant ivory, and that walrus ivory should be excluded from those laws. Yes, and definitely there is a need for education of the public and the market and the people. In fact, Indian Arts and Crafts Board is going to be working, or has been working with Kuwerik actually for a while, trying to doing research and pulling information for us that we could use in understanding how the ivory ban movement has been
going on and identifying the states that are considering or have enacted ivory bans. So one thing that we have, we are planning to do with the help of Indian Arts and Crafts Board and Alaska State Council on the Arts is to produce some information that's easily distributed, such as on brochures, providing information on what ivory is, how it's used, the value of the animal to us. So we're being proactive in trying to get people educated about the how negative of an impact these ivory bans have on we as Alaska Native people, and also Inuit people in other countries too. I'm sure that it is impacting ability in other countries, such as in Russia and Canada and Greenland.
And folks, there is another perspective for you coming to us from Rose Fostick, who is the vice president of the Natural Resources Division at Kuwerik Incorporated. She's also in Inupiaq. And is there anything that you related to in hearing her thoughts on this? Give us a ring, 1-800-996-2848. We do have an artist on the line. We have Susie Siluk with us. She is a traditional and contemporary artist. She's also a writer, and she comes to us from St. Lawrence Island, from the Yupik community there. And Susie, can you paint the picture more of just how all of this affects an artist? And maybe you even heard from some of your fellow artists about how this change, this ban, the threat of it going to more states is really put a jolt in the lives of Native artists.
Well, first of all, I would like to address some of the issues that Margaret brought up. She said there was a danger here in generalizing wildlife organizations in this whole scenario. However, I do think there is reason for concern when you do the research on the internet. And the MacArthur Foundation has done a lot of research in this area. They have a white paper out on the intersection between indigenous peoples and conservation. And there are documented a lot of human rights abuses in their work around the world. You know, oftentimes indigenous people become displaced from their territories, and also they're dispossessed of their resources there. So then when they go back in to continue their sustainable hunting, their historical resources, they then become poachers. So there's a lot of criminalization that goes on of indigenous people in the work of these wildlife organizations, and that should be cause for concern. That's not just the generalization that's out there already. In this case specifically, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, when I started getting their emails, they were urging everyone to converge in Hawaii so they could strengthen more their position to eliminate President Obama put it this way, virtually all ivory markets worldwide. And in fact, he gave a keynote address there, President Obama did, with this IUCN. And the Canadian Inuit Circumpolar Conference, they have people there representing our concern, and they did raise the issue, but they were more or less treated like traitors to the greater cause. So if these organizations are as committed to indigenous rights as they purport to be in some of their paperwork, saying that they're going to honor, the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, well, then they need to put some meat on that, because no one raised any concern there when the Canadians spoke up about this issue. That, this definitely was a problem for Arctic indigenous people. And further, then they urged everyone to converge on CITES in Johannesburg recently, and this issue came up again. I urged Fish and Wildlife to represent our concerns there and never received a response. In fact, there's been no response until just very recently from Fish and Wildlife on this issue. And this is a time-sensitive issue, because for the EU passed the seal ban on seal products, and this devastated 90% of the Greenlandic Inuit seal products market before the Prime Minister of Denmark belatedly stepped in on their behalf, and that was after the fact. So their market has yet to recover, and artists in Canada are also raising awareness and sensitivity and fighting that also. So this is a circumpolar Arctic issue. Wildlife organizations definitely are involved, and, you know, that should be looked at closely. I'm a little sick of losing my train of thought here, but I thought I would address, you know, what she was saying there also.
Sure, it's important information. I'm glad you shared it. We got a caller on the line we're also going to bring in. Let's go ahead and say hello to David in Lake Itasca, Minnesota, tuned in on KOJB. David, thank you for your call. And what would you like to share?
Just the ban on the elephant and rhinoceros, you know, the ivory from one spot is going to endanger the ivory from the other spot, and it's going to make it that much harder to protect the walrus, because the walrus ivory will become so much more valuable.
Okay. Thanks for that take, David. Hang tight. I want to go to Margaret. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know. I think that Vera is one of the key people going forward. I think the people who harvest walruses, you know, to maintain a sustainable harvest, people have an interest in protecting and managing the walrus well over the long term. So I hopefully, if the education goes forward, and there is a demand for legal ivory, then maybe, you know, in an ideal world, Alaska artists could continue and not only continue, but have even a greater access to the market. But I think, you know, the issue is sustainability and careful management of wildlife, and that is not happening with elephants, and that's why this ban is going forward. And so it's in our collective interest to make sure that does happen with walrus, and I think that's, you know, that's the shared interest of certainly us three on the phone.
And Vera, any thoughts?
Yes, this is Vera. Well, although, you know, we highly value the walrus ivory, to me it is more than this. We focus on the cultural and nutritional importance of hunting, and that includes walrus, because it is the necessity for our families, our clans, and communities working together to keep, you know, boats and crews hunting, heading out in very uncertain weather conditions without the assurance of successfully harvesting walrus and seals and bowhead whales. It's our connection to these. It's not as prey, but a very important part of us. We are so dependent on these animals as gifts to us. We highly respect this gift by using all that we can. That includes seal skin, baleen, bone, ivory. They're all, to me, very good expressions of this respect. As the marine mammal migration passes our communities and climate changes our conditions, one elder said, the window of opportunity is continues to shrink, making our hunting riskier and very less certain. So, but I wanted to end with one of our elders out on Gamble said to us, Winnie James, Guru, Susie will know. He said, they say to us to never give up on the hunting areas out there. Whether it be an accident or almost killed, we must not be discouraged. It is where we get our food from. And I think this is a very powerful and very humble words to share as we move forward in these in this discussion of the ivory ban. It's more than just the ivories. It affects us culturally, spiritually, nutritionally, and affects our identity. So I just wanted to end with that quote from Winnie James.
And Vera, I got one more question for you. Anything you want to say to states who are sitting on the fence on this, whether to ban walrus ivory or not? Any thoughts to them?
Well, I know that they're trying to just emphasize elephant ivory, and I hope that they do continue to do this. And I think it's not only education, but also doing a very good community outreach. We hope that as states who have passed legislation amended to not include walrus, and other states passing, maybe considering similar legislation, is just to specify elephant ivory only and continue to work with the state and federal legislative requirements in all these issues. So I just hope that, you know, California will amend their law to not include walrus.
All right. Thank you for that. And folks, that's going to wrap up today's discussion. If there was something you missed or you wanted to go back and give it a second listen, you'll find it in our archives on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. Thanks again to our guests, Susie Saluk, as well as Vera Metcalf and Margaret Williams. We are back tomorrow with our November Book of the Month, All the Real Indians Died Off, about countering some prevailing myths about our Native nations. We'll also be giving away books and connecting you directly with the authors. And thanks to the Native America Calling crew, our executive producer, Art Hughes, our senior producer, Monica Brain, our associate producer, Andy Murphy, and also thanks to Roman Garcia for engineering our show today. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm your host and producer, Tara Gatewood, and it has been a pleasure to reconnect with you. And we'll be doing it again the rest of the week after that, and as we get ready for another year. Folks, if there's anything you'd like to share with us, send us an email, comments@NativeAmericaCalling.com.
Support for this program provided by the University of Tulsa College of Law, offering a 100% online master's degree program in Indian law. This degree can move your career forward and help you work effectively in Indian country. Deadline for spring application is December 1st. info@law.utulsa.edu/MJIL. As an American Indian or Alaska Native, there is one simple thing you can do to help your elders, help young people seeking an education, and help develop Native businesses. Exercise your right to vote for the candidates of your choice on November 8th. Your vote on Election Day makes a difference in Washington, D.C. and at home. Vote for our people, our land, and our future. Know your rights and go to NativeAmericaCalling.com for more information. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.